Well, I have to start out with an apology. I've been working in pediatrics clinic the last month, and there are a lot of coughs. And I'm born and raised in San Francisco, so I've been doing a lot of yelling. And I really am at the end of my voice, so please just yell at me if you can't hear anything. I'm going to drink a lot of water. Today I'm going to talk to you about the social predictors of red cell distribution width. And this is something I did actually when I was at the NIH last year doing a clinical research training program here with some people there. So I do not have relationships to disclose. Okay, so red cell distribution width, I wouldn't be surprised if not a lot of you have heard of it. It is basically, it's a lab that you get in the clinical setting a lot. And actually, most people, if you talk to anybody who works in a hospital who's looking at labs, and no offense to anybody who is a hematologist here, but it's sort of deemed a throwaway lab. Nobody really looks at it unless you are thinking about something related to anemia, and even then, it takes a while. So what it is it's a measure of the variation of your red blood cell size. And it basically, it's the standard deviation of the red cell size, the average divided by the mean. So it's sort of this coefficient of variation. And essentially, if you have a high RDW, it means you have more variation in the size. So here on the left, if you have a bunch of red blood cells that look similar, as I copy and pasted them, this would be a very low RDW. But if you have on the right a bunch of different sized red blood cells in your body, then you would have a high RDW. And that's about the extent of my understanding of it, too. So now, initially, like I said, it's used in the workup of anemia by clinicians. But there's been growing enthusiasm among vampires and general clinicians because it's been associated now with some other health outcomes and broader populations. So a lot of studies in the past 3 years, actually, have looked at this. And it turns out that having a high RDW, again, that's more variation in your red blood cell size, is associated with longer hospital stays, longer stay in the intensive care unit, and all-cause mortality. And also specific population mortality, including heart failure, people with peripheral artery disease, people with coronary artery disease, and then intensive care unit patients after discharge. So there's a lot of growing interest in this biomarker. Okay, so this is one of the studies that was looking at this in a general population a few years ago. So this is using the NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. So a lot of you have heard of that, and it's a national data set. Basically, they took quintiles of red cell distribution width, and they looked at mortality over time. And as you can see on the bottom, the red line, that's people with high RDW, and then as you go up in the lines and the colors, black at the top is people with low RDW, and you can see that those with a high RDW are dying off more quickly than those with the low RDW. This is ages 45 to 64, but then more dramatically for people over the age of 65, you can see the more dramatic separation here based on quintile of RDW. So in general, the take-home is that high RDW equals poor health outcomes. Recently. So they looked at this a little bit more and did a meta-analysis and looking at cardiovascular disease mortality, and you can see this is percent increase in risk of death, percentage increase in RDW, and you can see, or point increase in RDW, I'm sorry, and you can see that overall it increases the risk of death for cardiovascular disease, and similar, it increases the risk of death for cancer mortality. And this is the other causes of mortality since they separated it out. Again, increased risk overall. Growing interest in this biomarker and trying to figure out how exactly it links to health. So switching gears a little bit. So everybody in this room, I think, is familiar with the social determinants of health and social gradients in health. In general, studies find that those with lower socioeconomic status, as measured by income or education, have worse health outcomes. And this has been looked at in a variety of outcomes and predictors. You can see here on the bottom, this is the risk of death by income. And you can see as income increases, the risk of premature death decreases. And then also there's a lot of studies looking at racial and ethnic disparities in health outcomes that I've been talking about. So there's also been an increasing focus on biological mechanisms through which the social determinants may be working. So in the question of how does social disadvantage, you know, quote, get under the skin. And so, for example, this is just looking at education. And I'm sorry, it's a small writing, but you can see here this is a high blood pressure, and as education increases, your percentage of high blood pressure decreases. Again, as education increases, percent with poor glucose regulation decreases, and then percent of inflammation decreases as you increase in education. So, as I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir, there are social gradients in health and a lot of different outcomes. So this led to the research question combining these two things. Are social factors associated with likelihood of having a high RDW in a national sample? So we also used the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and we pooled the years 1999 through 2010, so a good 12 years there. And so if, for those of you who haven't used it, this is the nationally representative sample using sampling weights, and it's available online, publicly available. We looked at people ages 45 and older because that's where a lot of the studies of RDW had been done. And so this led to our sample of 13,460 after losing some people to all the characteristics that we controlled for. That was about we lost about 20%. And so our outcome was a high RDW as measured by greater than or equal to 14.0. And again, so any clinicians in the room who've seen this before know that some, you know, in the clinic, having a high RDW is usually over 15 or so. But for this, again, these general epidemiology studies have shown that 14 is actually a cutoff that you can see some of these relationships with poor health outcomes come out. So we use that. And then our predictors were education with having no high school degree, having a high school degree, having a college degree. Then income as the percentage of the federal poverty level. So it's less than 100% was poverty. 1 to 200% was middle income. 2 to 400, it's, 1 to 200 low income. 2 to 400 middle income. And then greater than 400 was high income. Then race ethnicity, we used what was available in the NHANES, which was Mexican American, other Hispanic, black non-Hispanic, white non-Hispanic, and then other race ethnicity. We also looked at marital status, and so we looked at people who are married or living with a partner, people who are widowed, people who are divorced or separated, and then people who were never married. And then we also looked at a cumulative social risk, which was basically you got a point for having less than high school education, less than 200% of the federal poverty level, or having no partner. So you could have 0, 1, 2, or 3, depending on how many of those factors you had. Okay, so then we just did logistic regressions, and then we used we controlled for this. What I'll be showing you today, these are the covariates we controlled for, but we did a lot of other models. So these models today are controlled for age, gender, smoking status, body mass index, cancer, congestive heart failure, diabetes, history of myocardial infarction or heart attack, history of stroke, pulmonary disease, recent hospitalization, white blood cell count, albumin, bilirubin, C-reactive protein, and then RDW measurement method, because halfway through the years they switched to a new measurement method for looking at RDW. And so these are all things that have been correlated with blood in some way that we wanted to make sure we were controlling for. So the results. So this is looking at education as the predictor, and again, logistic regression, so you're looking at, this is the reference group here, having a college degree, and this is odds of having high RDW compared to the reference group here, and you have to forgive me, this should be a high school degree, not some high school. So you can see here, not as much of a gradient, there's no difference between having a high school degree and college degree, but you can see those who did not have a high school degree had increased odds of having high RDW compared to those with a college degree. Confidence intervals overlap here for these groups. And this is income. Excuse me. So you can see here, this is more of the classic social gradient. These are people with high income here, and then compared to those with high income, you see an increased odds of having a high RDW as you decrease your income. So these are the middle income, the low income, and then those in poverty, almost two times the increased risk of having a high RDW. And this is looking by race ethnicity, and the reference group here is white non-Hispanic. And you can see that for Mexican Americans, other Hispanics, and then black non-Hispanics have an increased odds of having a high RDW. The other race ethnicity category overlapped with white non-Hispanic, though. And you can see quite elevated for blacks. And this is marital status here. So you can see the reference group is married or living with a partner, being in a partnership. And you can see compared to those married, those who are widowed, divorced, separated, or never married have a much higher odds of having a high RDW compared to married. And then this is the cumulative model. And again, this is you get sort of a score of one for one risk, which is less than a high school education, less than 200% of the federal poverty level, or being unmarried or not living with a partner. So as you increase the number of quote, social risks here, you sort of go up in your odds of having a high RDW. So potential mechanisms. So this is still being sort of postulated by the people who are finding RDW being correlated with the cardiovascular outcomes. So you can look at it in several different ways. One is that social factors lead to a high RDW, which then lead to effects on health. Or you could say that social factors lead to poor health outcomes, and then this in turn is reflected in your high RDW. So this is just one way, and then any comments would be great too, because I do not know the answer to this. But studies have shown that social factors increase levels of oxidation in the body, and they lower antioxidant levels, which then can lead to increased RBC, red blood cell, fragility, and lower red blood cell lifespan, which in turn increases your RDW. Another pathway is through increased inflammation. So a lot of studies have shown social factors, low socioeconomic status being associated with increased inflammation. And inflammation is associated with disruption of iron metabolism and red blood cell production, which in turn is reflected as a high RDW. There's also nutrition. We've seen that social factors influence nutritional status, which again is reflecting the high RDW if you have low levels of folate. And also stress. We know that stress is associated with social factors. And stress has been shown to actually disrupt erythropoiesis, which is the production of blood cells. So it is feasible that this could operate through a mechanism of stress. And then, if this is causing a high RDW, then you could think that this can lead to hypoxia and then poorer health outcomes over time. So then this is the other way, which is saying that social factors are influencing health status, and this in turn is reflected by a higher RDW. I did this on a Mac, it shows. One way is through, health status basically initially manifests through subclinical processes and disruption of a lot of regulation in your body, and so this is measured by a high RDW as one of the factors. Or perhaps it's a global measure of dysfunction, and that's what RDW will pan out to be in the end. The implications are that the study shows a link between social factors and this emerging biomarker for mortality and other outcomes. It's a potential integrative marker of social disadvantage, particularly as measured by inflammation and oxidative stress. And one leading theory is that red blood cells actually essentially are sponges for free radicals and oxidation in the body, and sort of the more stress and oxidation you're having, red blood cells sort of buffer that, and then once they're disrupted, then you're sort of you're less immune to this global dysfunction. So it's a potential pathway there, and it may reflect sort of global inflammation and oxidative stress that's happening through other mechanisms. It also may help to assess cumulative burden of social disadvantage, as we saw that there was that gradient there. And RDW does suggest a potential pathway through which some of these social disadvantage gets under the skin. So as we are trying to figure out mechanisms and interventions, it is interesting to postulate the pathways through which this might be happening. And also, it's a very inexpensive and accessible test. So it's, you know, usually this is less than $10, which is pretty good for a, you know, a biomarker to look at. So I'd like to acknowledge Kshang Patel and Tammy Harris, who they were my mentors at the NIH where I did this work last year, and Nancy Adler, my mentor here at UCSF. And then again, this was part of the work I did as an NIH clinical research training program, which is, so it is funded by the NIH, but some of the funding has actually come through Pfizer. But let me assure you that there were no perks. I didn't even get a water bottle from Pfizer. So, but essentially, it is a public-private partnership that goes to the program there. Thank you.
So we'll take questions for all the speakers. We have plenty of time. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Holly Kine. I'm from Weill Cornell, New York. And I was interested, Dr. Cantel, at the high rate of RNA confusing for people who were black. I was wondering if they controlled at all for people with sickle disease, because that can give you a high.
Yes, that is a great question. The check is in the mail for you, because that that is something that we were thinking about, and we actually did. And I didn't show. We did a lot of different controls here to look at that. And so after controlling for, you know, they didn't have a consistent measure of sickle cell disease or thalassemia or any sort of traits. So, which is something we really wanted to control for. So the best we did is we looked at. We looked at hemoglobin, and we looked at white blood cell, and white blood cell can be elevated in sickle cell disease, and then hemoglobin can be lowered, and those were sort of our best attempts. And so we controlled for these and actually a couple of other blood cell factors, and it goes down, the relationship between, the odds ratio for black, but it still remains above 2. It was about 2.5 times as much. So, it, again, it's not the best measure, but that's something we were considering, is that it might be elevated slightly just because of the increased incidence of having trait or disease in blacks. But we think it's still not explaining all of it. So. Sorry, for people in here, the question is about the recovery of red blood cells and sort of the measurement. And so is it sort of like, I guess, a cumulative measure of the stress over time, or is it recover after sort of, is that pretty much? So yeah, so it's the red blood cells themselves, are dying, you know, every 120 days or so. But the dysfunction that is captured by the RDW is something that's a little bit more a little bit more stable. So it's kind of like, I mean, I think of it as more like a hemoglobin A1C. Have you heard of it? Like, you know, sort of this long, you know, month measure of sort of like a your glucose control versus like the blood glucose right then and there. So like, it takes a while to get an RDW that has changed from baseline. So it could take you know, several months or years to get it a little bit out of whack. But similarly, it could go back to normal. So except for if it was going through the pathway of affecting like erythropoiesis itself, the production of red blood cells, this would be more of like a several month to sort of year indication. So there is some assumption in this that this is sort of happening over time and staying this way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's not necessarily like a lifetime accumulation.
Right. So exactly. So and for example, like if you this is also like RDW gets out of whack if you start bleeding from somewhere and then your marrow starts producing new blood cells and that type of thing. Like you get different sizes because the new cells are different sizes than the old cells, and so acutely you can get a high RDW, and then it goes back to normal once you've been given blood. And you know what I mean? So it is true. You have to take it in the context of what's happening at that time, and that's why I think in the sort of the community samples it's like a more sort of powerful finding, because theoretically, these aren't people who are sick and having processes that are affecting their blood cell production acutely, at least that are usually measured. So does that make sense? Yeah.
I have one question. You said the age group was in the 40s and above. Did you look at anything with people taking aspirin regimens or anything like that?
No, that is when we actually could. So we didn't. We didn't directly look at it, so only as so far as like it's correlated with some of the diseases here, but not specifically. And they do have that, so you would hypothesize that it would be.
Just knowing how aspirin often is in that pathway.
Right. Yeah. It would be great to go back and actually look at see if this varied by people on medications that are affecting inflammation. Because again, and even as you get to the older age groups, you know, there's more and more use of that for arthritis and that type of thing. It could totally be affecting it. So that's a great idea. Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. And I think, I think some of that is going to be answered more and more in the next few years because, like, the paper's looking at this for diseases besides, I mean, it's been used for iron deficiency anemia. And now this, you know, is associated with nutrition, and nutrition is associated with socioeconomic status. So that is one big player. And in terms of the other diseases it's associated with, I think we're just finding out now that it's associated with all these cardiovascular diseases. So I think one of the models we did controlled for iron deficiency specifically, as a sort of a proxy for nutrition status and that type of thing, and it didn't really change anything. But I do think, as we look at this more, we might be surprised to see what RDW is associated with, and if that you know, befalls socially disadvantaged populations more. Right. Yeah. Because. Right. Right. But it could be affecting the RDW. Yeah. So I think the meds is a great call to throw in there for some of the future models. So thanks for the suggestion. Yeah.
Have you looked at the relationship between RDW and human coronable A1C?
A little bit. We just started to as I left the NIH. so I think they're working on it now. I worked in the lab on epidemiology, demography, and biometry, where they're interested in a lot of this stuff. And I almost hesitate to say what it was because I don't remember it, and I think it's because it wasn't showing anything that we expected initially, but we barely started. So I think it's a great idea because you'd think that, you know, these are both things measuring red blood cell in particular damage, and there's a lot of things that maybe could influence both of them. So, but the answer is not really yet. But
Well, thank you everyone for coming this early in the morning.